From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now. The FBI investigation into Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh is now underway, and so is a new round of political fighting. Kavanaugh's confirmation is on pause while the FBI interviews key witnesses who may have information about Kavanaugh and the sexual assaults he's alleged to have committed at drunken social gatherings in high school and college. President Trump says he has not put any limitations on that investigation, but Democrats say that is not true. We're joined now by NPR lead politics editor Domenico Montanaro. Domenico, good to have you. Thanks for being on.
And thank you for having me.
So there are questions from Democrats about the scope of this investigation and who exactly is dictating where it can go. Can you give us any clarity about who the FBI will or will not be talking to?
Well, we know who they have talked to a little bit so far. They have talked to Deborah Ramirez, for example, one of the other people who are alleging sexual misconduct on the part of Brett Kavanaugh while she was in college with Brett Kavanaugh at a party where they both were drinking. And so we know that they've at least spoken to her. We have heard that the White House would prefer the FBI not to speak to Julie Swetnick, for example, who was another person who had come out saying that she had seen sexual misconduct on Brett Kavanaugh's part when they were in high school. But we don't know exactly how far the FBI is going to go. They only have a week's time or less than that at this point. So it's unclear just how many interviews they can possibly do to get it wrapped up in that amount of time. So we'll see where that winds up going.
One of Kavanaugh's friends at Yale says that he will submit a statement to the FBI today that will describe Kavanaugh as a belligerent drunk when they were in college together, which would refute Kavanaugh's testimony on Thursday. Will details like that be considered? Is the FBI going to take that letter into consideration at all?
Well, you would think if there was a deeper investigation, I've heard some former FBI agents talking about and saying that if there was this kind of new information that would come out, they would want to talk to everybody that they possibly could. You know, we'll see if they wind up doing that. The bigger thing is this is political. You know, this is not a trial. This is not a prosecution. This is not something where Brett Kavanaugh is going to be found guilty of anything at the end of this process or at the end of this week. So the information that's coming forward has to convince, you know, a few wavering Republicans if they believe that it gives them enough confidence that Brett Kavanaugh did nothing wrong and was not culpable of any kind of sexual misconduct, or if they're comfortable with his nomination based on whatever the FBI winds up finding as it talks to these various witnesses.
Well, let's talk about those wavering senators, those wavering Republicans. Here's Jeff Flake on 60 Minutes describing how the protesters who stopped him in the elevator just before the Judiciary Committee meeting on Friday helped him decide to call for a pause while the FBI did that investigation.
I just knew that we couldn't move forward, that I couldn't move forward without hitting the pause button, because what I was seeing, experiencing in an elevator and watching it in committee and just thinking this is ripping our country apart.
So Flake will be a key vote here, of course. So will Lisa Murkowski and Susan Collins. Do we know anything about how they're feeling in terms of the scope of this investigation?
Susan Collins tweeted on Friday that she agrees with this, what she called sensible agreement to go and have a further investigation. In fact, I think, you know, what Republicans are hoping is the most likely scenario here is that a limited FBI investigation that maybe doesn't look at everything, you know, winds up giving Republicans a degree of political cover to say that they're comfortable, that they haven't been able to corroborate the stories from 1982. And that they are okay with Brett Kavanaugh at this point. You know, Jeff Flake, before what happened to him in the elevator, had said he was going to vote for Brett Kavanaugh. So right. We'll see if there's something that changes his mind.
Briefly, the Supreme Court starts its new session today. It has a pretty low-key docket, which may not be a surprise considering this fight that we've been talking about.
Yeah, pretty awkward, though, to start with just eight justices. They heard two cases today. And, you know, technically, Brett Kavanaugh could actually rule on these cases if he is, in fact, confirmed after not hearing the arguments, which would be kind of odd. And a lot of people looking at that and saying there's no real precedent for that. So how this court goes is anyone's guess at this point, depending on how long this controversy continues.
NPR lead politics editor Domenico Montanaro, thanks very much.
You're welcome.
Well, the other thing on the agenda in Washington today is a new trade deal with Mexico and Canada that will replace NAFTA. It's called the U.S.-Mexico-Canada Trade Agreement. President Trump talked about it this morning at the White House.
I have to certainly give my highest regards to Prime Minister of Canada, Justin Trudeau. A lot of stories came out about Justin and I having difficulty together, and we did over the trade deal. But I'll tell you, it's turned out to be a very, very good deal for both and a very, very good deal for all three. It puts us in a position that we've never been in before.
Change in tone there from the president. Let's bring in the CBC's Evan Dyer in Ottawa. Evan, the deal has a new name, but how different is it from NAFTA?
Well, there are some technical differences. It is basically, in most respects, the same agreement. It's free trade. You know, it was never really fully free trade between the U.S., Mexico, and Canada in the way you see it in the European Union. In the European Union, for example, countries can't accuse each other of dumping and they can't impose countervailing duties. And under NAFTA, you could do that. And then, of course, the countries had a remedy to seek to resolve disputes. And that's the NAFTA that we're going to have under the USMCA. In fact, the same system around dispute resolution has survived intact, which is quite a relief for Canada. That was one of its red lines. It wanted to have those independent panels rather than have to fight these cases out in U.S. domestic courts. So in that respect, it looks very much the same as the old NAFTA.
How are Canadians feeling about it today?
Well, Canadians, first of all, I'd have to say they're relieved because NAFTA represents a huge part of the Canadian economy. Canada, being a smaller country than the U.S., is more of an exporting nation because its own domestic market is smaller. Being a smaller country next to a much bigger country, of course, that other country's market is more important proportionally to each Canadian's pocketbook than it would be for each American's. I mean, the overall effect on both economies would probably be detrimental if free trade came to an end, but it would be felt more here. So relief would be the main sensation here, I guess. But then different sectors react differently because there are winners and losers. There are others who see a sort of a status quo that would probably describe the majority of people. There's relief in the auto sector. There's a little bit of dismay in the dairy sector. And that's sort of what we expected.
What do you not know about this deal yet that you'd like to know?
Well, there are a lot of questions about the tariffs that have been put on Canada outside of NAFTA, those national security tariffs that upset everyone.
Steel and
so
aluminum
much.
You're talking about.
Well, steel and aluminum, and of course then there was also a threat for cars and trucks. Now, as a result of this arrangement, USMCA, it seems that the threat of tariffs on Canadian cars and trucks will go away. That would have been a real killer blow. Trump called it the mother load last week in that news conference in the Lotte Palace Hotel in New York. But the steel and aluminum tariffs are going to stay in place. The U.S. is insisting, oh, that's not part of NAFTA, that's a separate track. Canada's hoping that this investigation by the U.S. Department of Commerce will have concluded by the time this deal is actually signed, and they will have come to the conclusion that Canada is not a national security threat to the United States, and that those tariffs will then be lifted anyway. But it's pretty odd to be going into a new trade agreement with each country having $16 billion mm-hmm. worth of tariffs against the other, and in the case of the U.S., you know, literally describing Canada as a national security threat. And that, as much as the dollar amount, has certainly annoyed people in Canada.
Well, let me finally ask you about that then. This negotiation has been pretty ugly between President Trump and Justin Trudeau, the Canadian
yeah.
Prime Minister. I did notice that the name of this agreement is the United States-Mexico-Canada Agreement, with Canada
yeah.
last, even though alphabetically it would be first
yeah.
or maybe even second. I mean, what do you think this has done to the relationship between the U.S. and Canada?
Well, on the name, first of all, I must say I was in that news conference in New York last week, and Donald Trump was talking about he liked the name USMC because it sounds like U.S. Marine Corps, right?
Right?
So the name of the agreement probably doesn't mean that much because he had already said that when there was a bilateral deal between the U.S. and Mexico, it was going to be the USM. So now Canada, the third to sign on, it sort of follows, I suppose, that it would have its name at the end. Here, people are not focused on the semantics. Nobody really cares about that. He can call it whatever he wants. But with the relationship in general, yes, this has been seen in Canada as an exercise in arm twisting and bullying. There has been a lot of misinformation put out by the White House, including the basic claim that there's a deficit with Canada, which is simply not true. U.S. Department of Commerce figures show that that is not true. This is a balanced trade relationship in which there's actually a slight surplus for the U.S. with goods and services over Canada. One of only two countries in the world, I believe, the U.S. has a surplus mm-hmm. with is Canada. So Canada did not understand why it was called on to make all of these concessions. And was surprised, actually, when Donald Trump campaigned against Mexico and then governed, it seemed, turning his attention more on Canada, making a deal first with Mexico, which is a low-wage environment, and really putting the screws to Canada. So will there be lasting damage? You know, I don't know. I mean, Canadians take a dim view generally of the Trump administration. After Donald Trump is gone, will that linger on? It's always difficult being the smaller neighbor dealing with a big country like the U.S., and sometimes you just kind of have to learn to roll with the punches. And in this case, I guess preserving NAFTA meant just kind of going along with certain things that Canadians felt were unfair if for the greater good.
CBC's Evan Dyer joining us from Ottawa. Evan, thank you.
Thanks, Jeremy.
Two people in eastern Russia told the Washington Post on Friday that they recognized one of the men suspected of poisoning former spy Sergei Skripal and his daughter earlier this year in England. They say he is a decorated military officer. And if that's true, it would back up the British government's claim that the two men behind the attack are Russian military intelligence officers. Russia says they're just civilians. The British investigation that identified the men relied on footage from closed-circuit television. And to help crack the case, Scotland Yard used a group of detectives known as super recognizers, people with an uncanny ability to remember a face. And that got us wondering, how does that work? Josh Davis studies super recognizers in the psychology department at the University of Greenwich. Hi, Josh.
Hello.
And Kenny Long, who used to be a detective in the new Scotland Yard super recognizer unit. Kenny, welcome to you.
Hiya.
And you are a super recognizer, is that right?
I certainly am, yes.
How in the world does that work?
I haven't got a clue. I'm quite lucky. I can see a face, and if I see it once, I will remember that face again.
Really? So if you saw me on the street, for instance, in 1986 when I was 5 years old and then we met again today, would you recognize me?
I'd be quite confident. We've done quite a lot of tests, many tests with Josh, and I'd be quite confident I could do that.
When did you realize you had that skill?
I didn't realize until I was working in the police, and I was told to go up to New Scotland Yard and get some testing done with Dr. Josh Davis because I was doing very well identifying people from closed circuit television, and I didn't have a clue that I could do it until that point.
Really? So, and how does it work for you? If you just see a little bit of someone's face, like an ear sticking out from beneath a cap, for instance, or an eyebrow, is that enough?
It certainly is. You'd be quite amazed. I've actually identified people from the back of their head for burglaries before. So it is a very strange ability, but when it comes off, you're very excited. The thing is, every single time I look at a face, I get an identification, I notice someone. It's like being a rock star in your sort of own world. So for a rock star going on stage, that's exciting for them. Put me in a room full of people and pictures, that's amazing for me.
You like that?
I absolutely love it, and all super recognizers do.
It's not a burden. So in other words, I see thousands of faces every day. I wouldn't want to remember each of the details that I pick up.
It can be a burden, to be quite honest, because you could be walking down the high street and someone would walk in towards you. They might smile, so you think, I know that person because you recognise the face, but you don't actually know them. So you go and say hello to them. They're like, I don't really know you. The problem is, because if you're walking in the same area quite often, you'll see the face, you'll recognise the face.
Huh. Do you have to commit the face or the details of the face to memory, or is it involuntary?
It's involuntary. You don't really have to try. You can just be walking down the street, you'll see that face so many times, I've recognized them years later.
And you didn't know this until you were working with the police as a grown man? It wasn't something that you recognized when you were a kid that, oh my gosh, I've got this strange talent?
No, that's totally correct. I did not have a clue. I thought that everybody could do this. I thought it was a natural ability for everyone. And so I didn't have a clue. But the second I found out I was a super recognizer after doing the tests with Dr. Josh Davis at Greenwich University, that's all I've thought about ever since.
Huh. You, as you say, took these skills to your police work. And let's talk about this case of the Russian spy poisoning in Salisbury. Of course, you were not involved in this investigation, but take us inside that department. How would this have played out behind the scenes?
So firstly, I know the guys dealing with it would have been very excited because the whole point is they're going to get lots of footage to view. And for us, that's a very exciting thing because that gives us time to review the CCTV. We know we've got to look for certain people, or if not, we've got to identify people from the footage. So we'd use many different techniques, like linked series identification, whereby we keep going through the footage until we notice an anomaly, so a same person appearing. And obviously, because we're super recognisers, we'll recognise that person. That will go to memory. And then if we see that person again in another bit of footage, we'll start building a picture, and then we can start seeing, is that the person we're looking for?
Now, London, as you well know, is one of the most surveilled cities in the world. There's some estimates that there's something like a million CCT cameras capturing hours and hours of footage every single day of the year. How important is that trove of evidence for you as a detective in that unit?
I think it's absolutely brilliant. It's estimated about 1.5 million cameras now in London, and I think it's absolutely marvellous because being on that super recognised unit, which I was, we used to get so much CCTV come through to us, pictures of suspects, but also we're not always looking just for suspects. Sometimes we have to look for victims, we're looking for missing persons, and having all that CCTV available to you really helps solve crimes and find people.
Well, what kind of cases did you crack?
A really good one was there was a male who was one of Scotland Yard's most wanted, and he was believed to be out of the country at the time. So I was in London, and I've seen a car drive past me, and I've actually noticed a suspect. I'd never met them before, but I'd seen a picture of them before. So I've gone around in the police car, pulled him over. He's given me false details, but straight away I've realised it was him. And he'd been stopped several times by other police officers who hadn't recognised him, being London's most wanted. But luckily, straight away, I got him in cuffs. When we took him back for fingerprinting, it confirmed it was him.
People probably shocked when you tell them how you found them.
We did get that quite often. We even had one guy right from prison. I can't believe you got me for that one. So they do appreciate it. It's a very unique skill.
Wow. Josh Davis, let's bring you in again from the University of Greenwich. What does the science say about how this works?
Well, the science says we think this is sort of innate. We think that super recognizers are less than 1% of the population. Very, very few people have this ability. We've found some very small differences in the way that their brains function. And I think that's the sort of direction that the research may be going in future.
Is it a matter of having a very, very good memory, or is it a completely different function of the brain altogether?
We think it's a different function. It's quite an interesting question, that, because people have done research on world champion super memorizers who perhaps can count hundreds of packs of cards or something like this. And when they tested their face recognition ability, they found that they were not very good at all. Hmm. On the other hand, super recognizers seem to have average IQ. They seem to be average at recognizing other types of objects, recognizing sort of streams and numbers and words and things like that. So it does seem as though it's a unique skill that is specific to faces.
Would there be an evolutionary reason why humans might develop a skill like this?
No, in fact, almost the opposite, because as you could imagine, in sort of prehistory, people lived in very, very small communities. Needing to know a large number of faces wouldn't have been very necessary. So that's a sort of strange situation as far as the science is concerned. It may be that what's happened is the part of the brain associated with other aspects of object recognition has somehow changed slightly in these super recognizers to become very, very good at face recognition. But that's a hypothesis. That's not the science, definitely.
Well, look, computers can be trained to recognize faces as well. How does the human brain compare to what artificial intelligence can do?
Okay, so with very, very good, high-quality images, computers are operating at about the same level as an average human being. Super recognizers are still better than the best computers in the world. But with low-quality images, which most CCTV footage is, human beings still beat computers. I think in the future, what the situation is going to be, it's the best algorithms working with the best humans, the super recognizers, to make the most accurate identity decisions.
What are the limitations that people like Kenny have?
So a human being needs to sleep, unlike a computer. We get tired, fatigue. There must be a limit to how many images and how many people Kenny can see before he does get fatigued. So that's one limitation of humans. What's really, I think, impressive about Kenny's skill is his ability to rule out the huge number of faces that he knows are not of interest to him. Because obviously when they're searching through CCTV footage for a suspect, for a target, most of the time they're actually looking at faces of people they're not interested in. That is what a super recognizer can do.
Josh, I know you've worked with Scotland Yard in the past. We know they're recruiting people like Kenny from within the force to be tested for this skill, but what about other places? Do you see super recognizers being used in this country, in the FBI, for example, or are you noticing this getting some traction in smaller police departments around the world?
We have worked with one Asian police force and also a German police force. It's almost certain that every large police force in the world will have some super recognizers, just because they seem to be evenly spread around the population. We've tested large number of Americans. We have found American super recognizers. Whether or not any of them are in the police, I do not know. So, yes, they solved so many crimes, thousands of crimes in London. Why not in New York, in Boston, anywhere else?
Kenny, you're not with Scotland Yard anymore, but I wonder how unlocking this skill, and really, I guess now an identity, there's a name for you as a super recognizer, what it's done to change your life.
Personally, I'm really, really happy. It's really changed my life. My life is 24/7 super recognizers, but what I notice is everyone who is a super recognizer really loves what they do. Everyone is very enthusiastic and everyone wants to get it right. So I think that's what's really important.
Oh. Kenny Long, former super recognizer with the New Scotland Yard, and Josh Davis, who studies this fascinating phenomenon for the psychology department at the University of Greenwich. Gentlemen, thanks to you both. Really appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Bye now.
Think you're a super recognizer? We've got a test. Here in now.org.
This message comes from NPR's sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
Republican Lisa Murkowski is one of a few key senators who will decide the future of Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh. The Alaska senator agreed that a final vote on Kavanaugh's nomination should be delayed for a week while the FBI investigates claims of sexual assault against him. And since then, some constituents have been protesting outside her office in Juneau. Liz Ruskin is D.C. correspondent for Alaska Public Media, and she joins us now from Washington. Hi, Liz.
Hi, Peter.
A lot of people want to know what Lisa Murkowski is thinking, but it seems as if she has been a little shy of reporters lately. Have you heard anything from her in the last few days?
She is not saying what she thinks right now, and I wouldn't expect her to. We do know that after Christine Blasey Ford testified, that Senator Murkowski said she found her to be very credible. That was before the judge spoke at the hearing. So we don't know what he said about that. But Murkowski is a moderate, and she sticks to a moderate position in all things. It's part of her temperament. It's part of her how she got elected.
Uh-huh. So she is a moderate, and she's shown streaks of independence before. She cast a vote last year that helped block the repeal of the Affordable Care Act, but she's still from a conservative state. So how do voters feel about that? Are they okay, for instance, with her decision to delay the vote?
I'm not sure about that specific question, but we do have polling about how Alaskans feel about it. And slightly more Alaskans want her to confirm. But among Murkowski's base, the people who have a favorable view of Murkowski, a majority of them want her to reject Kavanaugh. And in general, conservatives and the Republican Party don't really have a big hold on Murkowski. And I think they're used to Murkowski disappointing them.
You asked her last week if she ever had a Me Too moment, and she said yes, but she didn't elaborate. Do you think that's factoring at all into her decision here?
It factors in that she's an American woman and had some kind of experience that she didn't want to talk about. I don't think there's any reason to believe that it has a direct impact on how she's thinking about this.
So do you get the sense that if there's no new significant information in that FBI investigation, that she will be inclined to stick by Kavanaugh in the end?
I think that she would be inclined to stick by Kavanaugh because she has always voted to confirm Republican Supreme Court nominees, and she has rejected both of President Obama's nominees. So I think that is her inclination, but she is getting a lot of pressure from the left to vote no.
Do you think she relishes this role as someone who has so much sway in this huge decision?
No, I do not think she's not a flashy senator. She does not like to be in the spotlight for a national issue like this. However, we do know that she is able to use her status as a swing vote among Republicans to get things from leadership that she feels are important to Alaska.
Liz Ruskin, a D.C. correspondent for Alaska Public Media. Liz, thank you.
Thank you.
The Nobel Prize in Physiology or Medicine was awarded today to James Allison and Tasuku Honjo for their discoveries on how to use the body's immune system to attack cancer. Allison is the chair of immunology and executive director of the immunotherapy platform at the University of Texas MD Anderson Cancer Center. And joining us now is Dr. Peter Pisters, who is president of MD Anderson. Dr. Pisters, welcome and congrats to you and your colleague on winning a Nobel Prize.
This is fantastic news, of course, for Jim, for MD Anderson, but most importantly for cancer patients around the world.
Well, tell us a little bit about James Allison's work in immune therapy to attack cancer.
Well, Dr. Allison has really dedicated his entire life and his research career to understanding how the immune system works and more specifically how it works in cancer patients and in the biologic setting of cancer. And his main insight was to understand how to block a protein on T cells that acts as a brake on their activation, in essence, enabling those T cells to be freed up to attack cancer cells.
So explain that in a way that everyday people could understand it, because that's you're still probably at doctor level.
Well, in our bodies, we have a group of cells that we think of as the soldiers of the immune system, the T cells. And those T cells are really held in check to ensure that those cells do not attack normal cells in our body or cause autoimmune diseases. And part of that break process also impairs the ability of those cells to attack cancer cells. And Dr. Allison really understood the underpinnings of how that break works and developed approaches to release that break so that the immune system could, in essence, target and attack the cancer.
And so what has that meant for cancer treatment in general?
Well, this has really opened up an entirely new field in cancer treatment that we call immunotherapy. And we see that really as a fourth pillar of cancer treatment, joining surgery, chemotherapy, and radiation, and creating an entirely new way of approaching cancer treatment that can be combined with the other treatments or sometimes used in isolation alone.
Do you think we're going to get to a place because of this where people don't use chemotherapy and radiation to treat cancer?
Absolutely. I do believe that this will lead to insights and to opportunities to see this as a sole form of treatment and allow us to reduce the side effects associated with other treatments as we really look for new ways to treat cancer.
What kind of results have you seen in patients whose cancer treatment includes immunotherapy?
Well, we've seen spectacular results, including patients who are surviving for decades as a result of these novel treatments. When we look more specifically at the populations that have been treated by the drug that Jim's team has developed, we can see that 20% of those live for at least 3 years, with many patients living 10 years and beyond. These are really unprecedented results for patients who really had no other options.
James Allison started his career at MD Anderson in 1977, and then he returned in 2012 to work on the MD Anderson Moonshots program, which we've talked about before, basically allowing people to work on things that might pan out and might be game changers, or maybe they won't. How many examples like this have you had of the Moonshots program really giving you good results?
Well, this Moonshots program really has enabled us to move into what we think of as team-based science, and we're seeing tremendous successes as a result of this, both scientific discovery as well as policy initiatives that we've moved forward in Washington and Austin and other state capitals.
According to the World Health Organization's International Agency for Research on Cancer, an estimated 18.1 million people will develop cancer and 9.6 million will die of cancer this year. How hopeful are you about the future of cancer treatment right now?
Right now, we're in an unprecedented era of cancer treatment. We have the combinations of targeted therapy, immunotherapy, and the use of science as a way to drive discovery, as opposed to the historical approaches of screening the environment for compounds that might have anti-cancer effect. This change in research strategy, coupled with the types of innovations that are heralded in today's Nobel Prize award, really open up avenues that create great opportunities for cancer patients in the future.
That's Dr. Peter Pisters, the president of the University of Texas MD Anderson Cancer Center. Thank you so much, and again, congratulations.
Thank you so much.
Well, now to Spain and the city of Pontevedra, population 80,000, where you're more likely to hear chirping birds than honking horns. That's because much of the city is now car-free. No parking spaces, no traffic lights, and a 97% cut in auto traffic since 1999. Freelance journalist Stephen Bergen wrote about this. He joins us on Skype from Barcelona. Welcome.
Hi.
And did they ban cars entirely in Pontevedra?
Well, they banned them from initially from the historic part of the city, the medieval city, which is about 300,000 square meters. And then they extended that to a slightly bigger area, which is sort of the 18th, 19th century part of the city. So the city center is car-free, and then it's ringed by areas where you can drive and also where there are a lot of places to park.
And how is that working out?
It's working out very well. I think, you know, like most of these things, there was a lot of resistance. People, you know, associate having cars with their personal liberty. But I spoke to lots of people while I was there, and I couldn't find anyone who criticized it, even though, you know, this is a part of Spain where it tends to rain quite a lot. It's on the Atlantic side of Spain, mm-hmm. and people tend to get into their cars whenever it's raining. And lots of people said to me that it's just changed their habits, really.
What about emergency vehicles, police, fire, ambulances?
Well, you know, all of them can get in the city, and there are also taxis. You know, the rule is quite strict. I mean, the mayor said to me, if you want to get married in the old city, the bride and groom can come in a car, but everyone else walks.
What about businesses? Are they happy with this? Because you would think that many people would want to drive to get to a shop or a restaurant where they want to go.
Well, that was business where it was opposed to it exactly on that basis. Although in these old cities, it's very, very difficult to park. So the reality is, in fact, businesses survive better than in some small towns where, you know, they still allow cars, partly because it's just simply nicer to walk around. The other thing is that the city authorities combined this policy of banning cars with also banning the building of big shopping centers on the outskirts of town, which tends to destroy small businesses within the town.
So you spoke with the mayor of Pontevedra. What did he say about why he wanted to do this?
Well, he basically said that the old city was, you know, effectively a dump, that it was that people didn't like going there, that it was full of abandoned cars, there were a lot of drugs, And he, within the first month of coming to office, basically he cleaned it up and banned cars, which is, you know, clearly something, you know, he said he'd been, you know, he's been researching into this for some time before he took office. And I think partly because he did it swiftly, it was, you know, there was kind of a fait accompli.
What about CO2 emissions? What happened to pollution as a result of this?
Well, pollution, according to their statistics, went down within the city center by about 70%. Accidents went down with pedestrians to almost zero. And I think in the past 4 or 5 years, it's been zero of either people injured or killed. So, you know, these are significant gains. Obviously, you know, it's also, you know, it's general gain for people's health if people walk or people cycle. You know, this is what everyone is to some extent aiming for in cities.
Now, Pontevedra is a small city. Many people probably haven't even heard of it. But there is a larger city in Spain, Madrid, that's actually considering doing something similar. What are they thinking about in Madrid?
Many, many cities in Europe are about 80,000, 100,000, like Pontevedra. So, you know, what has been done there could easily be applied in these cities. In a big city like Madrid, obviously, it's a different story. I think, you know, what they're aiming for is to bit by bit exclude traffic from the city center. I mean, part of what is being done, it's also being done here in Barcelona, is to simply make it less convenient to drive by creating more cycle paths, by making it harder to park. So eventually people sort of get the message that they might as well use public transport or get a bicycle.
That's journalist Stephen Bergen joining us from Barcelona. Stephen, thank you so much.
A pleasure. Thank you.
So what do you think? Would you want your city to go car-free? Would that be possible? Let us know at hereandnow.org.
The school year is well underway, and some students are finding out they don't yet have a permanent teacher. In districts nationwide, finding teachers and keeping them is an ongoing problem. In Oakland, California, one school district started the year 30 teachers short. And that's why the story of Dr. Lou Paulette Taylor at McClyman's High School caught the attention of KQED's Vanessa Rancagno.
On the first day of school, Miss Cynthia from the front office is running the registration tables. Hallways are full of students and teachers chatting, and after days of buffing, the checkered linoleum floors are gleaming. Upstairs in room 308, Lou Paulette Taylor is getting ready for class.
You know, you have a new chance to make new mistakes and to do things better than you did the year before, you know, so it's new. It's exciting.
Not exactly what you'd expect to hear from someone starting her 49th year on the job. Nearly all those years right here at McClyman's. Taylor goes by Dr. Taylor, or most of the time, just DT.
Everybody knows who DT is.
16-year-old Kayon Green is a little nervous about his first English class with her. DT's got a reputation.
As soon as you step in, that's the first thing you'll hear about. DT, DT. That's what I was hearing about. I didn't know who she was.
Her students start filing in.
Missy over there, pull that shirt down. You know better. Schedule's in the wire basket, no phones out. Why is the hat on in the building? Okay, everybody ready? Okay.
Dr. Taylor starts off by telling the class about herself.
I graduated from McClyman's, 50-some years ago, 1966. I grew up in West Oakland on 9th Street between Cypress and Center, and I went to Prescott. How many people went to Prescott?
There's no whispering, no phones buzzing. She tells the kids she turned down other job offers to stay here.
You know, I just felt I should be here because this was home and this is my neighborhood, if you understand that. Okay? Some of you, I taught your grandparents. Ooh, grandparents. I can't even believe it's been that long.
Now it's the students' turn to introduce themselves.
Okay, we're going to start over here. Should we start over here?
Over there.
You want to start? You have to come up here because it's getting practice for senior project and other presentations you're going to do in this class. We're always here.
Just start over here.
Okay, come on.
Kayon steps to the front of the class.
All right, I feel good today. You know, I woke up feeling good, look good. I'm excited to be a senior because I like to be looked up to, you know, by the 9th and 10th graders. I'm anxious about a DT class and how much work I'm gonna receive. Yeah, I'm scared.
Kayon is one of those students with deep ties to Dr. Taylor. She's taught generations of his family.
Since you know my mom and my dad, you know, I can't really goof around. A lot of teachers get ran out of here because of the students at MAC. Like, the teachers, I don't know, they don't get the same respect as she does. She don't ask for it. It's just given to her because of the history.
There are a few people on campus who share some of that history, but nobody's been here as long as Dr. Taylor. Rilonda McGee is a school social worker.
The turnover at our school is, it's like sometimes we meet new teachers on the first day or in our professional development, and by Christmas they're gone. Sometime Thanksgiving, they're gone.
At McClyman's, only about 15% of teachers stick around for a third year, one of the worst retention rates in the district. McGee cites high turnover among administrators and inexperienced teachers.
There's a lot of trauma that our kids face, and some adults cannot handle that trauma. And they do a year and then they're gone because it's too overwhelming.
Dr. Taylor just soldiers through overwhelming. I ask what she thinks her job consists of.
Counselor, grandmother, auntie, cousin, social worker, preacher. You don't ever get to just teach, and you don't get to leave the kids here. If you're doing what you're supposed, you take them home with you mentally, and you try to figure out, what else can I do?
Yes, she says, some days she can get weary, but she's always learning. It's the part about school, about teaching, that she still loves.
It was something that I always wanted to be when I was little, I think because I always enjoyed school. I enjoyed reading. I enjoyed math. I enjoyed experimenting when we did science. I liked everything about school.
Dr. Taylor's almost 70, but she's not leaving anytime soon. It's not right here yet, she says. Too much coming and going. At the end of the school day, a former student comes by to visit. She's a first-year student at the University of Southern California.
When do you start school?
Monday.
Oh, come here. Okay, well, look, be good. Call me if you need anything.
Will do.
Okay. Oh, that's so exciting.
I know you're excited.
And I always tell them, I want you to be successful in your next life, and part of my job is getting you your little skill and tool bank together so that you know how to be your own advocate and find what you need and know where you can come back to and get help.
School's over for the day. Dr. Taylor could be heading home, but another student is walking in the door. For Here and Now, I'm Vanessa Rancagno in Oakland.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.